From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today on the program, the writer Michael Pollan is with us to talk about his new book on psychedelics. It's about this resurgence of interest in psychedelics and the potential to heal mental illnesses. The book is kind of a melange of natural history writing, of science journalism, even memoir. To explore the subject, Pollan took a few trips himself. After this.
Is something missing from your morning breakfast or evening dinner prep? How about NPR's critically acclaimed sound-rich stories alongside KUER's in-depth local news? Now with smart speakers, listening just became a whole lot easier. Tell Alexa or your Google Home to play NPR, and they'll take you right to KUER's live stream. Unlock the world of public radio with just your voice by telling Alexa or Google to play NPR, and never get stuck in the driveway again.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. So this is kind of hard to believe or hard to imagine, but in the 1950s, you know, the button-down 50s, the Eisenhower days, the pharmaceutical company Sandoz was giving out free samples of LSD to researchers. Most of this was confined to the medical community. It wasn't exactly public knowledge, but brain scientists at the time were incredibly excited about the potential for psychedelics. And in fact, they were using these drugs to treat things like depression and anxiety and alcoholism. But in his new book, Michael Pollan says, then something happened. The counterculture got hold of psychedelics. Young people started taking acid trips and recklessly experimenting. And so the stories of bad trips and psychotic breaks and suicides pretty much killed all that excitement. The culture and the scientific establishment turned against psychedelics. They were outlawed. They went underground. But Pollan's book is about how they're coming back, how psychedelics are having this renaissance, how a new generation of scientists are testing the potential of these powerful but mysterious drugs. Michael Pollan has been writing about food and culture for more than 25 years. Among his books are The Omnivore's Dilemma and Cooked. His new book is How to Change Your Mind, What the New Science of Psychedelics Teaches Us About Consciousness, Dying, Addiction, Depression, and Transcendence. Pollan joined us from his home in Berkeley, California, and he says that everything he was learning about the third-person history of psychedelic research made him want to explore all of this in the first person, too.
Well, in fact, I had written about it strictly in the third person as a very straight piece of narrative science journalism for The New Yorker the first time when I started interviewing cancer patients who had had psilocybin therapy. That's, you know, a guided session with psilocybin, which is the ingredient in magic mushrooms. And for a couple reasons, I felt I couldn't write a book without having these experiences myself. One is, it's kind of my stock and trade as a journalist. You know, I do immersion journalism. When I wanted to write about the cattle industry, I bought a cow. Right. When I wanted to write about architecture, I built a house. I really like putting myself in the story when that perspective will give the reader something they can't get any other way. And it's fine to interview people and get their stories, but for such a weird experience as a psychedelic trip, it's very hard to understand what it's like from the outside. It's such an internal experience. The other reason was, though, that I was frankly jealous of the people I was interviewing. They were having these big spiritual experiences, in many cases transformative. They had learned things about their minds and about the nature of reality that they didn't know before. And to hear people tell these stories is to feel like, wow, I have to see what this is all about. I'd never had a big spiritual experience, I didn't think. Yeah. And here was a door that you could open. And how would you not open it? The curiosity was killing me.
You describe yourself as a pretty skeptical person, philosophical materialist, really not someone who had been given to much of an interest in spirituality or mysticism in the past. But for some reason, this idea took hold of you. And I'm trying to figure out why it is, do you figure? Did it have something to do with turning 60 or your...
Yeah, I think it was a function of age in part. There were a couple things going on. I was approaching 60. My dad was very sick. He had a terminal cancer diagnosis. And so the kinds of questions that spirituality raise, you know, became more of more pressing interest to me. I think that was definitely a big part of it.
This is something you describe, what you call your default mode of consciousness, which is nothing too hot, nothing too cold. And it made you wonder if you should maybe reopen those accounts. And it seemed like expanding your consciousness in some ways was a part of a motivation.
Yeah, you know, when you learn that there are these other modes of consciousness available to you and that they're separated from you only by the thinnest of veils, as William James said in Varieties of Religious Experience, it becomes almost odd not to take a look. If there's something more to consciousness than this everyday normal default state we're in, yeah, curiosity got the better of me. I think that at different points of life, too, we have different needs and different kind of curiosities. And at this point in my life, exploring those other dimensions suddenly became pressing. Although I have to say it was in the service of telling this story. Yeah. You know, this is not just a memoir. There's a chapter that I call my travelogue and a couple other episodes where I describe my experiences. But lots of the book is looking at it as the journalist or historian would. From that third-person perspective. My interest as a writer has always been layering perspectives. I don't think any one perspective ever gives you the truth, whether it's the scientific, the historical, the personal. And it's only when you multiply them that you begin to get closer to the truth.
This also dovetails pretty well into a big theme in your work, of course, and that's the engagement with the natural world. And this seems like a question you've talked about is you sort of looking at all of the cultures, and almost all of them use plants to change consciousness. And it seems like this was a big question you were working through in the book as well.
Yeah, and that's a question I've looked at before. Yeah. People who've followed my work for a while know in Botany of Desire, I was exploring this whole issue of how plants evolve to gratify our desires. And the ones that figure out how to give us what we want or need are the ones that succeed on this planet. I mean, think about corn. You know, corn has been a great success because it gratified our desire for nutrition. But we have other desires too, and plants have evolved to gratify those. One is the desire for beauty, sweetness, and transcendence or consciousness change. And I was really surprised when I was working on that book to learn that every culture on Earth, with one exception, uses some plant or fungus to change consciousness. Now, that might sound like a weird expression, but you know, you've probably used plants to change consciousness today. If you I have a cup of coffee sitting in front of me, and that is a plant drug. A chocolate is a plant drug. Tea, tobacco. We routinely use plants in this way. The one culture that doesn't are the Inuit, the Eskimos. And the only reason they don't is nothing psychoactive grows where they live. But it's a limitation of their environment. They surely share that desire. And in fact, when they move to Canada or Iceland or wherever, they quickly begin gratifying it. So I've always found that a very curious thing. It's very easy to understand how the desire for nutrition is adaptive. It keeps us alive. Why would it be adaptive to change consciousness? And, you know, you could say it's for to relieve boredom or pain, and that's certainly reasons to do it. But then there are all these really radical consciousness-changing substances like psilocybin, like, other mushrooms and other plants. I mean, there's DMT is a powerful psychedelic contained in a great many plants. So what's that about? And exploring that desire and its uses, assuming it has some, and I did conclude it does have some, seemed to me a very compelling thing to explore.
Yeah. We'll get back to this, but one of the things that's interesting in the book is you write about that it wasn't until you had gone on this on these trips, I'll put it that way, until you had, as you put it, quieted your ego with psilocybin in one particular trip, you said that you were really able to sense that the plants in your garden had a spirit too. It seems like this gave you a new sense of thinking about the natural world in some way.
Oh, it did, without question. You know, most of us think automatically that we are the only perceiving, thinking, feeling subject in nature. Yeah. And everything else is an object. And that's our privileged position as humans with consciousness. I think this is a very arrogant mistake, and that there are a great many species that have their own subjecthood. Now, they may not have it quite the way we do. I don't believe plants have self-consciousness, but they have some rudimentary consciousness, if by that we mean awareness of their environment. And they have some agency. There are things they're trying to do. They're trying to, you know, find sunlight and reproduce and get more territory for themselves and their offspring. And but we fail to see this because we have this ego, this wall of ego around us that prevents us from seeing, you know, or offering the gifts of consciousness to other creatures in our environment. One of the things that my experience with psychedelics did was give me this very clear sense that the gifts of consciousness are spread more equally over the landscape than I had ever thought before. And I had written in Botany Desire this idea that plants have their own agendas, right, and they sometimes manipulate us. I don't mean consciously, but in terms of evolution. They get us to do things for them by gratifying our desires. And this, but this was kind of an intellectual conceit. What was amazing about this afternoon I had in my garden, and this was I had taken psilocybin mushrooms, was that I had this sense that there were spirits everywhere, that all the plants were very conscious, and that I was one of a whole symphony of perspectives in this garden. And it was quite a moving experience. Fortunately, the plants seemed very benign to me. You know, we didn't have any kind of tension between us. I know this sounds absolutely crazy, but in fact, it's a limitation of our perspectives that we see ourselves as the only perceiving subject and everything else is an object. And you know, that goes for people too. We tend to think of other people, especially those that aren't in our immediate circle, as objects too, objects of derision, objects to be walled off from us. You know, we're seeing this kind of ego consciousness throughout society right now. And one of the things that psychedelics fairly reliably does is bring down the defenses that protect us and allow new webs of connection or relation to spring up. And sometimes you feel them in very powerful feelings of love. And other times it's more in this sense of kinship that you have with, whether it's other people, with nature. So I find that's one of the more remarkable features of these drugs. Now, you can argue that these are illusions of the drug experience, but they sure don't feel that way when you're having the experience.
I was surprised at how much love came up in this story.
I was too. And it's a very common thing that people report, and they emerge from these experiences with, you know, this both banal and profound insight that love is the most important thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, kind of we've heard this before. This isn't news to anyone. But to feel it with the kind of force that people do is quite remarkable. And it's a kind of an insight like that acquires an authority that you almost can't believe. This is something also that William James talked about. He talked about the noetic sense as being a very common aspect of the mystical experience. And by noetic, he meant having the force of truth, you know, being objectively true, not just being an opinion or an insight, but being something that's come down to you on, you know, on tablets from on high. Yeah. And that's quite a remarkable thing too. And I think it's part of what allows people to change. You know, one of the reasons that we're exploring these psychedelics is not just for mind expansion, but for therapy. Right. And they're being given to people with depression, addiction, obsession. And they seem to make it easier for people to change their behavior or their patterns of thought. And one of the reasons they do that, I believe, is that you emerge with these insights. For example, the smokers I interviewed, people in a smoking cessation study being conducted at Johns Hopkins, you know, I would say, how are you able to stop smoking after a single psilocybin session? It seems so implausible to me. And they would say that, well, I had this amazing experience. This one woman said, I sprouted wings and I flew all through European history and I observed these amazing signs. And then I died three times and I watched my ashes come up from a pyre on the Ganges. And I stood on the edge of creation and watched it begin. And she said, after all that, smoking seems so, you know, what a terrible way to ruin your life. There's so much to do and see in the world. Now, people had surely told her that smoking was stupid before that, and she, I'm sure, knew that. But she knew it in a new way. It was a powerful revelation, almost, that allowed her to stop.
Well, it seems like that is such an important theme in the book, that this new era of clinical research for psychedelics, and that's what the book is very much about, this new renaissance of it. But it's not so much about the pharmacological effects, you say, but the mental experiences that it can give people. And that seems like the novel aspect of the potential.
And it's a very novel paradigm for science or for medicine when you think about it. But yes, what appears to have the beneficial therapeutic effect is not simply the drug. People can take the drug and not have the kind of experience that facilitates change. But it really is the experience. And some doctors call it the mystical experience. Others talk about it as ego dissolution. But unless you have this experience of your sense of self merging into something larger, the effects don't seem as pronounced. And so this suggests we really are prescribing an experience rather than a drug to people. And it's a conversion experience. Make no mistake. You start out one way and you come out another way. And this is a very novel thing, and it's hard for us to get our head around because that's not normally how drugs work.
Michael Pollan, his new book is How to Change Your Mind, What the New Science of Psychedelics Teaches Us About Consciousness, Dying, Addiction, Depression, and Transcendence. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West from KUER.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. A lot of people want to know, does Doug really read all those books? The answer, yeah, he does. No one really knows how, but we do know that he gets up very early. If you want to try keeping up with him, you can buy the book by clicking on the indie bookstores, Amazon, or Audible links at the bottom of the episode page. If you do, some of the proceeds go to support Radio West, so thanks for that, and thanks for listening. Here's the show.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the writer Michael Pollan talking about his new book on psychedelics. It's called How to Change Your Mind. One of the things the book reminds us of is, and this is going to be astonishing to a lot of people, I think, is that for most of the 50s and part of the early 60s, LSD, psilocybin, they were seen as these miracle drugs. They were peer-reviewed studies. It seems like we were headed somewhere. There was some trajectory there that this was going to be treatment, and then it just stopped.
Yeah, I was really surprised. I mean, like a lot of people, I assume the history of psychedelics begins in the 60s, you know, with Timothy Leary and the counterculture. So I was surprised to learn, as were many of the researchers, younger researchers working on this, is that in the 50s, for 10 or 15 years, there was a very fertile period of research using LSD and then a little later psilocybin, which doesn't really come to into the West till 1957, potential psychiatric treatments with real promise. There were 1,000 peer-reviewed papers on LSD and other psychedelics between 1950 and the mid-60s. There were 6 international conferences on LSD in that period. There were 40,000 research subjects. So this was not a small inquiry. This was a big deal. And what we were learning about LSD actually did open up some very interesting avenues of exploration in neuroscience. Yeah. The whole idea of a neurotransmitter and a neurotransmitter network really traces to the discovery that LSD, this molecule that in very small quantities could have these profound effects, that was a real hint that there was important chemistry operating in the brain. and that and really put us on the path that ultimately leads to the discovery of serotonin, which is closely related to LSD and psilocybin. Yeah. They're all tryptamines. And also to the discovery of the SSRI antidepressants. So this was really exciting stuff. And the era of neurochemistry is really ushered in by the discovery of LSD. And this research, you know, as you suggest, was bearing some really interesting fruits. LSD treatment for alcoholism became a standard of care in parts of Canada. The whole idea of that you needed a certain kind of conversion experience to get sober, which is, you know, kind of at the heart of AA, was that model was really explored using LSD. In fact, Bill W., the founder of AA, had LSD therapy in Los Angeles, and he was convinced it should be part of the program, that it could really help people get sober. He had gotten sober on another drug called Belladonna, which has effects somewhat like psychedelics. And, you know, the whole idea of the higher power in AA, which I've always taken to be a kind of dilute Christianity, may owe, in fact, to psychedelic experience and the sense that you have that there is some higher power. It may not be, you know, the Christ or the God of Christianity or even Judaism, but that is also a conviction many people emerge from, this sense of divinity. And the value of surrender too, I think. I mean, AA is interesting. It's very hostile to the ego.
Yeah.
It suggests that the ego is part of our problem and that we have to let go and surrender to a higher power. These are all psychedelic virtues.
Yes.
Although we don't usually discuss them in those terms. So I think that there are a lot of fingerprints of psychedelics in AA, which might be shocking to people in AA who, you know, because of the basic stigma on all inebriants of various kinds. But psychedelics are a little different. Mm.
You say in the book that there were a couple of things that convinced you this was going to be a good subject for a book. And there were some articles, there was a conversation you overheard at a dinner party, which you write about. And one that I wanted to ask you about, someone sent you a paper a few years ago, a scientific paper about, I think it was psilocybin research. And one of the writers, a man named Bob Jesse, he's an important character in the book and in the story. But explain the significance of this paper, because you say the things that, of course, stuck out to you were the words mystical and spiritual. They were, I think, words in the title, in fact. And it seems like this paper was really important to this psychedelic renaissance.
Oh, yeah. So this is a 2006 paper that comes out of Johns Hopkins. Roland Griffith is the main scientist. He's a very well-regarded drug researcher there who got excited about psychedelics when he had his own mystical experience, although he had this in his meditation practice, not on a drug. And he started getting very interested in these questions of mysticism and consciousness. And along comes Bob Jesse, who is a Bay Area former tech engineer who has had some transformative psychedelic experiences of his own and starts working to revive this research. He gets some money together and helps navigate the whole system. And together with Roland Griffith and some other people, they do a study to see whether psilocybin can occasion, that's the adjective they or the verb they use, a mystical experience in you know, healthy people. It's a very weird idea for a study. I mean, there's no therapeutic value to it, but they're trying to really understand these drugs. And they found in about 2/3 of the cases, a high dose of psilocybin could occasion a mystical experience. Now, what is a mystical experience? Well, of course, the shrinks have, you know, psychologists have a scale for everything and a survey for everything. And basing it on William James, it has this quality of merging into a sense of a larger entity. It has this sense of this noetic quality that what you perceive is so powerfully real as to be objectively true. It has a sense of ecstasy or bliss very often, a sense of sacredness. Everything acquires a new glow of meaning. You know, he has these 8 criteria. And they found that in 2/3 of the time that this drug would induce an experience that was indistinguishable from the mystical experience. And not only that, that these experiences that people were having on the drug in a room at the medical school at Johns Hopkins was among the top five experiences of their lives in terms of its significance to them. In many cases, it was the top one or two or three. I mean, these were experiences that people likened in their significance to the birth of a child or the death of a parent. That was amazing that a mushroom could create such an experience. And now, having realized that, okay, you can occasion this experience in the laboratory pretty reliably, that opens up this very exciting opportunity to study spiritual experience in a way that you haven't been. And so for me, when I saw that paper and the title talked about, you know, psilocybin can reliably occasion mystical type experience in people with sustained personal meaning and significance. I don't have it quite right, but that's pretty much what it said. I'd never seen those words together. I'd never seen science studying spiritual experience in quite this way. We were on a new frontier here, somewhere between science and spirituality, and that seemed very rich to explore. And that paper really does get some attention and leads to all this therapeutic work, trying to use that experience essentially to drive change in people who are stuck in depression or addiction, and then to use it with cancer patients who are struggling with what the doctors call existential or psycho-spiritual distress at the prospect of dying. So this is a very exciting frontier in scientific research. It is still just a frontier. There's so much more work to be done before we can say that these are, you know, FDA-approved drugs that can be prescribed, but we're getting there. And that's I find that quite remarkable.
Seems like the moral panic that you write about that sent us on another direction, it seems like that's starting to diminish a bit.
I think it is, yeah. I mean, I think that there are risks here. I think, you know, over-exuberance could sink this. You know, I think if it ever became politicized, things could go sour. But I think we're in a very different place than we were in the 60s. You know, in the 60s, these drugs became totems of the counterculture and were very disruptive to society. They were believed to be contributing to, you know, the unwillingness of American boys to go to Vietnam. You know, Timothy Leary, you know, taunted the government or the president by saying, "People, boys who take LSD won't fight your wars or join your corporations." And it was true. It was disruptive. But I think we're in a different place now. I think enough of the people in power are familiar with psychedelic experience that they're not going to react as violently as they did when it was so foreign and so strange to people in the 60s. Then there's this other reason that I think is the most important, which is essentially mental health care in this country is broken. That we have very little to offer people struggling with depression, people facing their death, people, you know, people with addiction. And that the tools that we have haven't really been innovated since the early 90s. You know, we give people antidepressants, and they help some people, but there are a great many people who hate taking these drugs, who don't like the side effects, have trouble getting off them. I mean, they're, you know, for all intents and purposes, addictive. And here comes a treatment that in one or two or possibly three sessions can provide relief to what is very serious suffering. I think, you know, people have an open mind about that. When you have so few tools, a new tool, even if on its face it sounds a little strange, is something you are more willing to look at. And I think that's where we are. I mean, if you compare mental health care in this country with any other branch of medicine, oncology, cardiology, infectious disease, there are not too many accomplishments you can point to. Rates of depression are rising. Rates of suicide are rising dramatically, 25% in the last few years, and rates of addiction are rising. So we're doing something wrong, and we need some new tools. And whether this is the tool, you know, remains to be tested. Right. But there's a strong signal it has something important to offer.
Michael Pollan, talk a little bit about exactly what's going on in your brain when people take psychedelics. One of the things we should maybe have you explain is this default mode network. Because the idea of trying to disconnect this or provide a filter for our ego is a critical part of it. It seems like what's going on in the neuroscience about all of this.
Yeah. So, you know, there's a lot we don't understand about what happens when you introduce a psychedelic molecule to the brain. It starts with the serotonin receptors, which are occupied by the psychedelic because they're very similar in structure to the serotonin. In fact, LSD fits those receptors even better than serotonin. That's why it lasts so long. It gets stuck there. Yeah. But what happens after that and the activation of those neurons is a bit of a black box. But the most interesting finding has been that using fMRI, if you image the brains of people on psychedelics, and they actually do inject people with a psychedelic and slide them into the fMRI scanner, which is seems like a horrible way to spend an afternoon, something very interesting and surprising happens. And that is that this network you referred to, the default mode network, goes very quiet. It is depressed in its activity. And this was a surprise. Everybody thought they'd see lots of fireworks in the brain, corresponding to the kind of fireworks people report on psychedelics, you know, hallucination and synesthesia and, you know, all the odd perceptions that people have. So what is the default mode network? It's a tightly linked set of structures in the brain that links parts of the cortex, which is the evolutionarily most recent part of the brain where our executive function lies, and many people think consciousness lies, to deeper and older parts of the brain involved in memory and emotion. The default mode network appears to be crucially involved in the generation of a sense of self. It's where we go to, you know, when our minds wander, it's where self-reflection takes place. Theory of mind, the ability to attribute a mental state to somebody else, happens there. The autobiographical memory, or narrative memory is there. It's where we tell the story of who we are, and time travel is there too. Our ability to think about the past and the future. All these functions are very important to generating a sense that we have a self that is consistent over time. And this may or may not be real, but it's certainly an illusion that most of us have. The Buddhists tell us it is an illusion. And so this self-generating system goes quiet. And in some people, it goes off. It turns off. And the people who reported a sense of ego dissolution, the sense that their sense of self was just kind of melting, are the ones that have the most profound drop in default mode activity. I mean, this is a very important network, and it performs a lot of very positive functions. Having a self, having a strong ego is very important to getting things done. Right. It gives us our drive for, you know, everything from, you know, reproductive success to, you know, getting ourselves fed and everything. It rewards us for getting the job done. On the other hand, in a lot of people, the ego can be a very punishing voice. It can trap us in negative stories about ourselves, you know, that I can't get through the day without a drink. I am unworthy of love. I'm a worthless person. It traps us in these loops of rumination and self-recrimination. And so quieting that voice appears to have a therapeutic value. And I think that that's a very important discovery. Now, there are other ways to quiet it. Meditation, interestingly enough, quiets the same network. So this is just one of the many ways in which psychedelics are teaching us very important things about the mind that we didn't know before.
One of the practical aspects of all of this is the story that you tell about a woman with ovarian cancer, a conversation you had with this cancer patient who had this experience where she saw her fear. In fact, she located it in a particular part of her body. And this insight that she had of extinguishing her fear in that experience seemed remarkably helpful and could seem remarkably helpful for other people suffering from actual physical ailments.
Yeah. So one of the – she was one of the cancer patients in the trial at NYU. Her name was Dinah Baser. And she was a figure skating instructor from Manhattan. She was about 60-ish. I don't think she'd had any experience of psychedelics. But she had been treated for ovarian cancer. And although the treatment was successful and she was in remission, she was terrified that her cancer would come back, and it was really debilitating her. So she enrolled in this trial, hoping to find some relief. And like a lot of the cancer patients, in her psychedelic journey, she found herself going into her body and kind of surveying what was going on in her body. And as you say, she saw something she wasn't expecting to see. She saw her fear, and it was a black mass underneath her rib cage. So she knew it wasn't her cancer. That wasn't the right place. And when she saw her fear, she screamed at it. She said, "Get the F out of my body." And, you know, imagine her guides who were with her, these two therapists, sitting there having no idea what's going on in her mind when this very, you know, small woman starts screaming. And as soon as she screamed at the black mass, she said, it evaporated. And with that went her fear. And I wrote about this in this New Yorker piece I did on these trials. And I wrote in my draft that – and her fear of death was substantially diminished or something like that, something safe. And when the New Yorker called her to fact check it and they read her the sentence, she said, no, he got that completely wrong. My fear was eliminated. And it still is. And she told me what she realized, the insight she got from this experience, was that she couldn't control her cancer. It was either going to come back or not, but she could control her fear. And that was one of these insights on psychedelics that is accompanied by this sense of authority that makes it so believable that she was essentially able to take that on board. And with that, her fear went away. I found that quite remarkable. Now, you could get there with years of psychotherapy, perhaps, and a shrink telling you that, you know, of course you can't control your cancer, but you can control your fear. But it is the power of that idea when you have it on psychedelics, I think, that makes it something you can really act on.
I want to ask you about your own mental travelogue with psychedelics, your own experience, which is a part of the book, of course. You point out that you had never been one for deep or sustained introspection. And so I'm wondering, as you approached the possibility of taking a trip, were you frightened? I mean, one of the things you write about is that you were really uneasy about the possibility of opening up some childhood trauma.
A lot can go wrong. Yeah, I don't want to make it sound like this is a risk-free thing to do. And I was very nervous about it. I had had very limited psychedelic experience when I was younger. And I had avoided psychedelics because I was afraid of them. I just didn't feel like I was a stable enough person to roll the mental dice with LSD or psilocybin. And you have no idea what's going to come up. People do surface traumas from their childhood. You know, I was afraid I might discover I was crazier than I think I am in normal times. And I had my share of worries. I didn't do this until I had done a lot of due diligence, you know, as a reporter to figure out exactly what the risks were. And I was surprised to learn that the physiological risks are not that bad. I mean, in fact, these are remarkably not toxic drugs compared to – there's no lethal dose for LSD or psilocybin. There is a lethal dose for the Tylenol in your medicine cabinet, you know, and it's only a handful of pills. They're also non-addictive. People don't get into habits of using these drugs every day. They don't work if you do that anyway. But it's the last thing you think of when you finish a big psychedelic trip is, where can I get some more? It's more like, do I ever have to do this again? Because it's very disruptive. Yeah. And you might have pleasure, but you might have, you know, incredible pain. I don't mean physical pain, but psychological pain. So, yeah, I was every night before I embarked on one of these journeys, and I did it, I guess, about seven times on different substances. I had a sleepless night of, like, arguing with myself, is this crazy? You know, you're going to go up on this mountain with this guy you barely know, and he's going to give you LSD. And, like, what if you have a heart attack? Is he going to call 911? Because it's going to get him in, it's going to put him in jail. That I'd have that argument. And then on the other side, I'd be like, but aren't you curious about what you might learn about yourself? Yeah. And you know, by the way, you got a book to write and you promised to describe these experiences. So it would ping pong back and forth all night long. But luckily I found that once I got there and passed the point of no return and put the blotter paper on my tongue or the mushroom in my mouth, I was able to surrender to the experience. And that is, I learned, crucially important. If you fight the experience, that's when you have a bad trip, so-called. Yeah. That's when you get incredibly anxious or paranoid, when you sense your sense of self melting onto the floor and you fight to hold on to it. You just have to let go, and a good guide will prepare you for that.
Turns out you're pretty easy to put under, you say.
Yeah, surprisingly enough. I did another experience where I did a breathing exercise called holotropic breath work, which is a way of inducing a trance without any drug at all, merely a certain pattern of breathing. Within a few minutes, I entered this very odd trance state. So, yeah, I'm a cheap date.
So you talked it over with your guide, this experience. You call him Fritz in the book, this LSD experience. And you both decided to go with this kind of modest dose. I have to say his instructions to you were really interesting. He compared it, he said, to seeing a mountain lion. When you get into this experience, don't run. Yeah. Stand your ground.
Yeah, that's the classic advice. You know, we see that in the parks here in Berkeley. Look big, stand your ground, don't turn, it'll chase you. And that's the so-called flight instructions that all guides give you, which is essentially if you see a door, open it. If you see a staircase, climb it. If you see something scary, don't turn and run. Step right up to it and say, what do you have to teach me? What are you doing in my mind? Mm. If you feel like you're going crazy, if you feel like you're dying, let it happen. It turns out to be very important advice because the resistance is futile and painful. And if you do succumb or surrender to what's happening, very often you'll pass through whatever the scary passage was. And you do see, you know, you can see terrifying things, but it'll pass into something much happier. When you stop resisting. And so, you know, it's John Lennon's memorable advice, and tomorrow never knows. Right. Relax your mind and float downstream. And he had probably heard that from, I don't know, Timothy Leary or somebody.
But, I think it was actually Timothy Leary heard that from.
Yeah, so that's one of the reasons, and we haven't talked about it that much, that I want to emphasize the importance of the guide or the therapist in these experiences. So the way that psychedelics are being used in this current renaissance of research is very different than the image many of your listeners may have of taking a handful of mushrooms and going to a concert or the very careless way in which these drugs were often used in the 60s. Yeah. I mean, people would put LSD in the punch bowl. Right. I mean, I can't imagine anything more cruel. Yeah. The way they're being used now is in a very carefully controlled environment with a lot of attention to what Timothy Leary called set and setting, the internal and external environment in which you're having this experience. And the guides are with you the whole time. There are usually two of them in the above ground trials, one if you're working with someone underground, which is what I did. These people know the territory well. They know how to prepare you, and then they sit with you for the entire time, which gives you an incredible sense of security. You know, if you're going to allow your sense of your ego to dissolve and put down all your defenses in life, you better feel very safe, or that's going to be a terrifying experience. Yeah. And so they create an environment. They talk about holding the space, creating an environment where you can surrender. And then afterwards, you come back, usually the next day, to have what's called an integration session, where you speak with them, tell them the story of what happened to you, and they help you try to make sense of it, underscoring certain themes, helping you find what insights, what revelations, if you will, are useful to you that you can take into your life and apply. And that is just as important as any other step in the process. So it's this three-step guided experience that we're talking about, not simply taking a pill and, you know, walking around the woods.
Fritz hands you a Japanese teacup, and at the bottom there's this tiny square of blotter paper. And at some point, as you explain it in the book, you were off. You were traveling somewhere in your mind, and you describe it as being overpowering. That's a word you use in the book. But it's interesting, you also write about how you still had agency. In other words, you could change the contents of your thoughts.
Change the mental channel.
Yeah. Would you just describe it? What's happening to your ego now at this point then?
Well, in this particular trip, as you suggest, I didn't have a very high dose. At the end, I think I was up to 150 micrograms of LSD. And so I wasn't at that point where I had lost the ability to shape what I was thinking about. I could, even though I was, it was like being absorbed in a very a powerful daydream without distraction, and that one thing would lead to another. And for me, it was I was kind of confronting or talking to people in my life. I mean, my parents and my sisters and my son and my wife, one after another, they kind of appeared to me. And but I could choose. I could say, I want to think about Isaac now, my son, and I could. I mean, it's almost like a very profound kind of meditation or self-reflection, where you do have some agency over the contents of your thought. On a higher dose psilocybin trip I had some time later, I describe as being in the front car of a roller coaster, and that the contents of consciousness, you have no control over them. You are completely at the mercy of your subconscious or wherever these things are coming from. So there are very different ways to navigate this space, and I think that's important to understand too. I had no idea, having read lots of accounts of psychedelic journeys, how much of the experience is really a kind of meditation, a very profound meditation where you can think about stuff and choose to think about stuff and work on things. So a lot of it has to do with dose, though. And frankly, if you're really getting upset, you can take – you're wearing a blindfold. I didn't mention that. You're wearing eye shades during this experience to encourage you to go inside. And all you have to do is take those off, and whatever hallucination you're having will stop. And you can actually pull it together for a period of time when you need to. So it's – I think the image people have, or at least the image I had, that, you know, it was a uncontrollable hallucination from beginning to end is actually not the case. It's a little more subtle than that. And even to call them hallucinogens isn't quite right.
Coming back to that idea of love, I wanted to read how you put it in the book during one experience. I think this was during the LSD experience. There came a cascading dam break of love. How do you explain that? How do you describe that?
Well, I think that's what happens when your ego defenses go down or are lowered to some extent. You know, we protect ourselves against strong feelings. That's one of the things our ego does. It protects us against death, strong feelings, strong emotions. And to the extent that you are reducing the influence of these defenses, these channels open up. And one of the things that flow through them is love. Yeah. And these powerful feelings for people in your lives. It's wonderful. It's also, it sounds like a Hallmark card. You know, love is the most important thing. But, you know, a lot of stuff on Hallmark cards, it's banal because of sheer repetition and the cynicism of the card company or whatever. But these are truth. And I say at some point, you know, are platitudes false? And what I suggest is, no, they're truths that have been leached of all emotion. And when you resaturate those truths with the power of feeling, you realize that, wow, they are true. Love is the most important thing. So, you know, you can sound like an idiot saying this, but I think that the line between profundity and banality is a lot finer than most of us appreciate.
Let me ask you this finally. You're not making an argument in the book for legalizing it or any kind of basic recreational use necessarily. I mean, you're very careful about this. And here's the thing that I think that you've talked about is that other cultures had these ceremonies, these containers where they used these substances. And you're saying what we need is the same kind of cultural container, the same kinds of ceremonies.
Well, we need our own cultural container. It may not be the same. Yeah, I think one of the really important lessons from history is that the cultures who have used psychedelics, and there are a great many of them, whether you're talking about the Aztecs or the ancient Greeks or the Siberian shamans, I mean, you find psychedelic use in many places over many periods of history. And what do you see? Well, you see the drugs being used very carefully in a very well-regulated way. So, for example, there are always elders there. There's a shaman or a healer who is presiding over this, somebody who knows the territory. People very seldom take the drugs alone. They take them under the supervision of someone or in a circle. There are always rituals and ceremonies. There are only very, very special specified times when you can take these drugs. And all of which suggests that these cultures recognize that this was a powerful substance and could get people into trouble, and that they needed to be very well governed in their use. And we need to realize that, because when the molecules came to our culture in the West in the 50s and 60s, they came without a context. Yeah. They came without ritual or ceremony. Mm. And we were not very good about figuring out how to use them. It was trial and error, of course. I think we're recognizing that they do need a container, a cultural container. Medicine may offer one, psychotherapy, but there should also be one for those of us who don't have pathological, you know, have pathologies of mental health. You know, the betterment of well people, as Bob Jesse puts it. There is a value for the rest of us in this. We're all stuck. We're all facing death, let us remember. We're all stuck in patterns of thought that we'd love to get out of. Many of us have intermittent depression or obsession, and God knows we all have addictive behaviors of one kind or another. So there's something here for a lot of us. And we need to figure out the container where that could happen. I don't think it's straight out legalization. These drugs are more powerful than cannabis, and I don't think that that's the right model. I think we're right to be on this path of seeking FDA approval for them as medicines. And at that point, we can explore, well, how widely prescribed will these be? But I do think that having a guide makes a tremendous difference, and that we're going to, if we do approve these as drugs, we're going to have to regulate them very carefully.
That's Michael Pollan. His new book is called How to Change Your Mind. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Tess Goodwin. The program was directed by Tim Slover, produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.